This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in for Miriam Sobe. Today we're talking about baseball in Indiana. If you have questions or comments on our show today, let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. You can also send us high-quality voice messages with our smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. It's free and easy to use. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Right now, we're joined by two guests to talk about local minor league teams. Preston Leinenbach is the communications director for the Evansville Otters, and John Nolan is the play-by-play broadcaster for the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. I want to start talking about the major disruption to baseball last year. Preston, can you tell us what happened to last spring's season?
So yeah, last year was pretty crazy. We were all preparing for the normal, usual season for us here in Evansville at Bossy Field for the Otters last spring. And then, of course, the sports world started to shut down. We tried to hold off as long as we can because at that time, a lot of us just didn't know what was exactly happening. It was new to all of us. And then eventually, by the end of June, our league, the Frontier League, officially canceled our championship season. So for us, that was pretty much it for the Otters. We just basically had to kind of just start preparing for this year in 2021 a little earlier than expected, try to host some other events that with whether it be wedding receptions or picnics, something that we can do in a safe manner. Got a few of those in before things really started getting bad again. And then eventually, nobody was allowed to come back out to Bossy Field once again, just due to tight restrictions last fall. So it was a tough year and kind of an odd year to go to the ballpark and not have a game every day last season.
Yeah, absolutely. And how did that affect players and other team staff?
So for other teams, especially here locally for us, Evansville, all of our players basically couldn't come to Evansville. Their coaching staff couldn't come to Evansville. We worked from home as most people did for a long time. And fortunately for us, we didn't really have any huge negative impacts on our office staff. We were able to stay intact. But for a lot of players, they were able to find some opportunities in states that maybe didn't have as much tight restrictions. So they were able to at least go and get some live pitches and live at-bats in. And then some just continued to train and work hard and just get ready for this year.
Yeah, yeah. So, John, what impact did that have on the Tin Caps? I know that revenue, that's a whole year of revenue. Can you talk a little bit about the effect for the Tin Caps team?
Right, and thank you so much for having me on. And unfortunately, here in Fort Wayne, a similar story to what Evansville experienced in so many communities across the country. In the case here with the Tin Caps, we are a single-A affiliate for the San Diego Padres. And so it was Major League Baseball that made the call last year to not have a minor league baseball season. And in a similar scenario here at Parkview Field in downtown Fort Wayne, we were quite limited in what we could do. And yeah, the reality is that is crushing. Even though Parkview Field does host hundreds of non-baseball events in a non-pandemic year, at the end of the day, this operation is based off of hosting thousands of fans for the entertainment of minor league baseball games. So you're talking about upwards of 90% of our annual revenue was gone. And so it was a crushing effect. The majority of our front office staff here was forced to be furloughed for the better part of the last year. Although fortunately now with our season here for 2021 underway, things are cranking back up and glad to have our staff back.
Yeah, and what sort of changes are being kind of forced to happen because of that loss last year?
Right, well, and a lot of it is at the discretion of Major League Baseball in terms of some of the health and safety protocols that we have here at the ballpark. But if you're asking that question from the standpoint of some of our operations are scaled back a little bit. And just something, for example, would be when it comes to our concessions, we sort of streamlined the menu, don't have as many of the extra extravagant options and don't have as many fireworks nights this year. Have to be a little bit more prudent in our part-time staffing when it comes to hourly workers, as you know, the budget will take some time to catch up after the big loss from losing all of 2020, pretty much. But again, glad right now that we are back and things are certainly obviously trending in a better direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know at least the baseball fans I've talked to are very excited about the return of the season this year. I'd love to talk about maybe some of the precautions or health and safety measures being taken. Preston, can you talk about some that are being taken down there?
So, yeah, things are looking positive and moving in the right direction here at Evansville. For us, we are technically allowed to go 100% capacity, but yet we still are needs to social distance. So we're actually going to start our season here in the next week at 75% capacity. So that way we do have enough space to the social distance everybody. Masks will not be required when seated or at all, really, since we're being an outdoor facility. But we are highly encouraging and recommending people wear masks, especially when they're up and about, walking around the concourse areas and concession lines, restrooms, just as a lot of restaurants have done here in the past year for us. And of course, we'll have sanitation stations located around as well. So we're still going to promote safety precautions, but again, there's no restrictions in place that we have to, I guess, forcefully enforce.
Mm-hmm. And John, what about in Fort Wayne?
And we just had our first five games of the season last week. To begin here, we're at only 30% capacity. That's a limit of about 3,000 fans compared to in the past seven. You know, 9,500 plus fans here. We, in accordance with Major League Baseball policy, we have had all fans wear a mask. Just in the last 24 hours, Major League Baseball has actually taken away that protocol, and we're still sorting out what we'll have in place for when we're back in action at home next week. But some other things would include that we have gone cashless this year around the ballpark when it comes to our concessions and our team store. You know, a lot of the little kids who come out here to games, a big part of the attraction is maybe getting a hug with our mascot, Johnny Tin Cap, after Johnny Appleseed. But for the time being, you know, Johnny's interactions with the community are limited. And this is definitely evolving. Like I said, Major League Baseball just had another change yesterday, too, where we've had the first couple rows of our ballpark all the way around the field were considered a buffer zone. And we've had cardboard cutouts in those seats. But now we will be allowed to seat fans in the first couple of rows. And so we do anticipate that our capacity will increase as this season goes along, but at the same time, working with our local health officials and making sure that we're being smart and not rushing into anything.
Right. And true to the pandemic form, as things are constantly changing. So definitely keeping on top of what's new and evolving as time goes on. So, John, I'd love to talk about sort of the value of local baseball. I mean, obviously, after a year of being inside and dealing with the pandemic and the hardships that have come with it, people are really excited to get back out there. Can you talk a little bit about the value of getting this season going for not only, you know, the athletes and the teams, but for the community as well?
Absolutely. And while we do produce guys who will go on to play in Major League Baseball and could be household names and stars like Fernando Tatis Jr. of the Padres, who we had in 2017, at the end of the day, the vast majority of folks who are coming out to our ballpark are doing so because this is a community gathering place. And whether it's for a Tin Caps game or whether it's for a concert here at the ballpark, we're in the downtown neighborhood and proud that Parkview Field has been part of a revitalization, not just in downtown Fort Wayne, but really throughout Northeast Indiana. And for a lot of people, you know, this is their happy place, especially when the weather is nice in the spring and the summer. So I know a lot of people, whether it's because they missed the baseball or maybe they just missed the taste of a good ballpark hot dog or just running into the friends walking around the concourse. This is a great gathering place. And certainly the more it fills up again, it is one of those examples of feeling a return to normalcy.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Preston, later in the show, we're going to be talking about the history of baseball in Indiana. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the role of local ballparks and ball teams in keeping some of that history of the sport alive. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, what that looks like for the Otters in terms of events or, you know, theme nights and that sort of thing to talk about, you know, where the sport has come from in the state?
So, yeah, here in Evansville, Bossy Field, the third oldest professional active ballpark behind Wrigley and Fenway, we strive to make sure we keep that history alive. 100 plus years of baseball history here in Evansville, 25 seasons now plus for the Otters. But for us, it's about maintaining the nostalgia of going to a traditional classic baseball game here at Bossy Field with not only natural grass and natural field, as a lot of ballparks now have turf fields, but also the aesthetic of the seats that we have. They're the old wooden seats. And that's just a big part of it. A lot of people have a lot of memories of coming here back to when Evansville had affiliated baseball with the Evansville Triplets. And with our new rebrand and logo this year, we try to kind of touch home with that, using similar colors that they had back in the day for the Triplets. And then going all the way back as well to the Evansville Braves and Evansville Evas. I mean, going a long way back, all the way to 1915 and plus here in Evansville. So we try to do that. And this year with our theme nights, we are going to try to put together an Evansville Triplets reunion night. We're also going to have a salute to the Negro Leagues night, as one of our former now deceased clubhouse managers used to play in the Negro Leagues, Sam Hartsfield. And so we are going to try to just kind of bring that all together that night, especially with replica uniforms and jerseys that the players would wear back then. And a lot of just different pieces of history that we try to pull together, not just this season, but we've also done in years past with team reunions. And again, coming off of our 25th anniversary season in 2019.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've got about 30 seconds left. John, can you talk a little bit about what you're looking forward to in Fort Wayne this season and when the season ends?
Yeah, and our season will be going into mid-September. It actually remains to be seen whether or not Major League Baseball will have a postseason for us. But, you know, fans here can look forward to $2 concession items on Tuesdays and paws and claws nights where pets are welcome to the ballpark on Wednesdays and discounted beverages for Thirsty Thursdays. But overall, and fireworks Saturdays, but overall, I'm most looking forward to, just as I talked about before, seeing people back in the ballpark, smiles on their faces if we're at a point eventually here where fans don't have masks on. And once again, just bringing the community together to celebrate our pastime and to also enjoy the excitement of the action.
Thanks so much. Preston Leinenbach is the communications director for the Evansville Otters, and John Nolan is the play-by-play broadcaster for the Fort Wayne Tin Caps. Thanks for taking the time. If you have questions or comments, let us know on Facebook or Twitter. We'll take a quick break and be right back. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in for Miriam Soeb today. We're back now talking about baseball in Indiana, heading into a discussion about black ball players and teams. We'd love your questions and comments on the topic. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. You can also send us a voice message through our free smartphone app called All In Vox Pop. Just search for All In Vox Pop on your phone's app store. Send us your question or comment, and we'll try to get it into the show. We're now joined by two new guests. Leslie Heafy is a professor at Kent State University and baseball historian, and Phil Dixon is a Negro National League researcher and author. Leslie, I'd like to start with you. What got you interested in baseball history, and what sets Indiana's apart compared to other states or even other sports?
Sure. Thanks for having me. I got interested in baseball as a little kid. My dad played baseball in college. And so, and growing up in New York, lots of opportunity to see and watch baseball. And so that's where my interest came from. And then I was able to combine that just baseball interest with my history interest. And so as a history professor, I get to teach about baseball and the Negro Leagues and things all the time. So that's where it comes from. As far as what Indiana itself, I find Indiana to be a fascinating aspect of the larger history of particularly the Negro Leagues, because it's not a state that people tend to think about for baseball. Most people's first thought when they think about Indiana is basketball, right? And so the idea that there is this incredible history that dates back into the 19th century and then really takes off when we start to think about the Indianapolis ABCs and the Indianapolis Clowns. And then we also discover that there's a very rich history in Indiana of minor league and barnstorming that went on simply because of the travel that so many Negro Leagues teams did coming out of Cincinnati and Dayton and things, and the necessity of travel simply because teams needed to make money. And so the opportunities that small towns in Indiana, from Richmond to French Lick to West Baden, they all played a role. And so it's not just the big major league teams that we think of when we think of Indiana. And so that's why I think Indiana has a really interesting place to play. And then I know we're going to talk about this later, but there's also some very unique connections for women's participation that happened through the state of Indiana as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I've learned a lot just in producing this show. So I'm really looking forward to having our discussion today. So, Phil, you've written a lot on the Negro Leagues. Can you tell us what teams were in Indiana in the National League and some of the others that stand out to you?
Well, of course, you can't talk about Indiana without talking about the ABCs. And, of course, the ABCs were a strong team even before they joined the Negro National League in 1920. For instance, in 1906, they had a record where they had played 139 games and won 133 of those. So they only lost 6 games. So they were setting this tradition for Indiana baseball going way back. And so they brought some really good players through there. And once again, they used the surrounding towns and their locality to help teams come out of Kansas City, St. Louis, Chicago, and to play in Indiana, right in Indianapolis. So a lot of great history there.
Yeah, and I know that one of the names that's come up a lot is Oscar Charleston. Can you talk a little bit about why he's an essential name in baseball?
Yeah, I think in my estimations, Oscar Charleston, you know, when I was growing up, I used to hear about Reggie Jackson being Mr. October. But I tell you, the original Mr. October had to be Oscar Charleston, because at the end of the year when they would play these exhibition games, man, he would just eat the major league pitching up. So this was a great player. Could hit, could run, could throw. Hey, could pitch if you needed a pitcher. Also hit for power, and it was just a clutch player. He goes on after his playing days to become a tremendous manager with the Harrisburg Giants, also the Pittsburgh Crawfords. Hey, and even came back to manage the Indianapolis ABCs in the 1950s. So this was just a tremendous ball player and a credit to Indiana and its contributions to the Negro Leagues, which were many.
Mm-hmm. Right. And Leslie, I've also heard a lot about the Taylors. Can you talk, give us a brief explanation on who this family was and what's remarkable about them?
Sure. When you're talking about the Taylor family, we usually start with C.I., Charles Isham, right, who was involved with the ABCs as the early manager, challenging Rube Foster often and C.I. certainly is sort of the brother that you think about, but there are three others, Candy, Jim, Ben, and John. Ben, of course, is actually in the Hall of Fame, first baseman. And so you've got a history with four brothers, players, managers who all contribute across an extended period of time between the four of them, of over 30 to 40 years of playing, not only in Indiana itself, but across the various Negro Leagues that you think about. And of course, when you talk about CI, it also brings up the discussion about his wife, Olivia, who becomes first significant female owner of a Negro League team in the 1920s. And so it's a unique family to see four brothers all participating at the incredible high level that all four of them did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So, Phil, you recently wrote a book about two players, Dizzy and Daffy Dean, and their barnstorming tour playing Negro League teams. I've heard this phrase. Leslie even used it at the top of the show. What is barnstorming? For someone who doesn't know the history or what that means, tell us what that is.
Yeah, barnstorming was actually it comes out of the entertainment. the theater, where organizations would play a series of nightly stands in more than one town. So they might appear no more than maybe two towns, you know, at a time, and then they're going to move to the next one and the next one. So it was set up where they worked, you know, like a steady radius, usually by train, later on by bus. And it was a night after night with different cities. And the Negro National League, when they started, and still to this day, they are America's only truly barnstorming league. So you might have, like, for instance, the ABCs, you know, they're going to play in places like Kokomo. You know, if you can imagine, they would go and play Negro League games in Kokomo. But at the same time, you know, they're going to come down through the Midwest, and they're going to play maybe in Columbia, Missouri, and they're going to play, you know, small towns as they work their way to the weekends to play the major games. So barnstorming was a active part of the Negro Leagues. And of course, they're playing during the era of great town teams, so, and semi-professional organizations. So there was lots of competition, lots of money to be made. And Negro League teams, in addition to playing their own schedule, they played a schedule outside of the league, and it was quite profitable. So that's pretty much how barnstorming worked. It was quite profitable to do that kind of baseball.
Right. And I know that you've both talked about players you think should be in the Hall of Fame, especially, you know, talking about the Taylors, only one is in the Hall of Fame. Leslie, can you talk about one player you think should be there that isn't?
Well, I think when you're talking about Indiana itself and the connections there, you could make the argument. I mean, there's many, but I think you could look at CI himself as one of those who certainly ought to be given consideration for his long years of managing, not only with the ABCs, but also before that with the Spurdells, and just the talent level that he brought into the game. I also think, and this is just, I think it's worthy of consideration, that Olivia Taylor ought to get some consideration, at least recognition, not necessarily because she is the first woman that we see as an owner of a team in the 1920s. And she's there for 3 years at a time period when, once again, that is just not something that was going to be done. And she didn't just sit in the background. She attended the Negro National League meetings, and she simply didn't sit back and say, nope, this is not my world. And so I think, you know, not a player, but I think she is certainly worthy of discussion, at least within those circles. And so those would be two that I would just throw out.
Right. And Phil, how about you?
Well, one of the ways I look at it is, you know, we talk about the Hall of Fame a lot, but, you know, when you really think about the whole history of the Negro Baseball League, you know, one or two men don't make an entire baseball team. It's been my discussion the whole time. So it's hard for me to talk about Indianapolis baseball and not mention players like Quincy Troupe or Leonard Griffith or Elmer Heron, John Donaldson, Fred Hutchinson, Bingo DeMoss, John Schaller, William Prim, Rand Butler, one of the owners, Dick Johnson, one of the great pitchers. And even Warner Jewell, who was the owner during the period that C.I. Taylor wasn't. So a lot of history there, and I think it's enough of this legacy to be spread around to some great, great individuals who contributed.
Yeah, and I'd add Dizzy Dismukes to that list as well. I mean, Phil just gave a wonderful list. I'd just throw him out too. And there's just so many. And I love Phil's point that it's not about a single player. And John Donaldson, certainly the argument can be made there. And talk about somebody who made his career on the barnstorming side of things.
Yeah, and obviously... go ahead, Phil.
No, I was going to say, for me, one of the things is I played ball growing up there in the 1960s, and I had a chance to see some actual Indianapolis Clowns players. So Hank Aaron was one that I had a chance to see. And then, of course, I saw John Wyatt, who played, and Paul Casanova, who played for the Indianapolis Clowns. Of course, at that particular time, I didn't know that they had played. So, but I did get a chance to see some Indianapolis talent in the big leagues.
Yeah, and obviously none of this was happening in a vacuum. I mean, so Leslie, can you talk a little bit about the relevance and lasting impact of the Negro League teams and players on the sport and Indiana?
Sure. The fascinating thing to think about is this is such an important part of baseball history, Indiana's history, and American history just in general. The Negro Leagues and those teams that played against Negro League teams are a product of American segregation and racism. That's what they are, right? And this wonderful opportunity and sport was born out of something that was that needed to be changed, that never should have happened. And so it's an important part of understanding what our past history is all about. And so all the men and women who participated, their stories are a part of that story, and they're a way for us to understand and to look back and see where we came from and where we are and what still needs to be done. It gives us a chance to look at the obstacles, the barriers that these people had, men and women had to go through in order to be able to play what was supposed to be considered America's national pastime. I say that because it's hard to think about that when so many were not able to play on an equal basis as others. And yet the Negro Leagues, the players, they flourished. There's incredible talent there. And so we also want to not see them simply in that light, but to recognize the incredible talent, the incredible baseball that was played. And so I think when you look at a state like Indiana, you get to see that and the contributions that these teams made, both teams that were native to Indiana, like the ABCs, right? The Clowns ultimately moved there, but also smaller teams like the Richmond Giants or the French Lick Plutos, right? Who contributed to the pride, to the economy of those communities, who gave people and Indiana something to be proud of. And you look back now on, you know, the Negro National League's very first game was the Indianapolis ABCs versus the Chicago Giants. And so there's a lot of firsts like that that Indiana can look to and say, this is something to be proud of, in addition to saying these are stories that need to be told.
Yeah. And Phil, what do you think is the legacy of the Negro Leagues, more broadly as well? I'm curious your thoughts in it, especially with the books that you've written and how much research and time you've invested in talking about this.
Yeah, there's a lot that I could say on that. And you know, I would say that they were equipped and ready for their opportunity. Yeah, the Negro Leagues, they were equipped and ready for this opportunity and this legacy that we're experiencing today long before American prejudice was willing to grant them the equal opportunity. So it's so wonderful to be able to tell these stories. And I think about some of the people that influenced me, Eddie Dwight, who played for the APCs, who lived across the alley from me. I'm happy to tell his story in connection with this. So it's just a part of me that I feel that needs to be shared. And I'm just doing my part to make sure that people know about this legacy in my lifetime, because some of these players will never benefit, or their families never benefited from the true experience of what they achieved in baseball.
So when it comes to, I guess, people who don't know much about this topic, I'm kind of talking about myself here. what recommendations or places to start do you suggest for folks? Phil, I can start with you, and then Leslie, if you have anything else to add. I'm curious, I guess, what you think people could dig into first or look at to talk more about this topic and learn more about some of the ins and outs and complexities of, you know, baseball history and the effect of it.
Yeah, I would say one of the things you want to do is you want to pick up some books and read. There are lots of books out there, so you have to be careful, because some of it is just the same cup of coffee warmed over. So you're going to have to read more than one book to get a true kind of vision of what was going on. And then the other thing is, you know, when you think about the barnstorming, we think about Indianapolis and its contribution as a city, but there's games also in Muncie and Myron. You know, I think I mentioned Kokomo earlier, that were Negro League games. And, you know, we, I didn't even mention Gary, which is outside of Chicago. So there's a lot of local history as well as national history. There's great players and exciting events. Matter of fact, I'll just mention one here. May 12th, just what, 2 days ago, 75 years ago, the Indianapolis played a Indianapolis ABCs played a 20-inning 3-3 tie with the American Giants in Chicago. Now, what's interesting is about that is they played a 15-inning 2-2 tie at Detroit's Navin Field, which later on became Tiger Stadium. So that kind of history is just sitting out there waiting to be told. And it's exciting stuff if you're a baseball fan. If you just love American history, it's also good.
Leslie, we've got about 10 seconds. Anything to add? Oh, did we lose Leslie? We might have disconnected from Leslie, but I want to thank our guests for joining us. Phil Dixon is a researcher and author, and Leslie Heafy is a professor at Kent State University. Thank you both for taking the time today. We'll be back after a quick break, shifting gears a bit to talk about college plans for the fall. If you have questions or comments, you can find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. You can also leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. I'm Jeannie Lindsay. Back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Jeannie Lindsay, filling in for Miriam Sobe today. We're moving off the field now and heading into a discussion about higher education in Indiana and what some colleges are planning for campuses this fall. And as always, we love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a short voicemail with your first name and where you're calling from at 866-476-3881. We're joined now by two guests, Kara Monroe, the provost at Ivy Tech Community College, and Susanna Rivera Mills is the provost for Ball State University. Kara, I want to start with you. I think the question that's on a lot of people's minds right now is what sort of health measures and precautions Ivy Tech campuses are taking or planning for the fall, what they can expect in that. So can you talk about any specific requirements for students or staff?
Absolutely. I'd be happy to. So we are continuing with the requirements that we've had in place since we reopened our buildings last fall, and that is that masks are required or facial coverings of some sort for everyone that comes into our buildings. We also are requiring social distancing continuing and encouraging folks to use hand sanitizer and wash their hands and practice all the hygiene practices that we've all become so familiar with during COVID. We are not requiring vaccines at this time, and I don't anticipate that that will change. And that is largely due to the non-residential nature of our facilities, as well as the open access nature of Ivy Tech, that we think that that is the most appropriate protocol. We're certainly encouraging everyone to get their vaccines and want everyone to do that if it's the right choice for them in consultation with their medical professional, but not requiring it for Ivy Tech students and faculty and staff at this time.
Mm. And Susanna, what about the health and safety measures at Ball State? How are you deciding what and what not to include?
Well, I think that we're very similar to where Ivy Tech is right now, as at least our current policies are following the same protocols. However, thanks to the continued dedication of our health and safety protocols, as well as the engagement of our campus community, Ball State University is really looking forward to the opportunity to fully resume in-person operations this fall. As a matter of fact, our Board of Trustees recently approved our return to traditional modalities this fall, and also resuming our traditional academic calendar. We have been working with a number of groups and partners. We had established an academic planning task force internally that has guided our decisions around what to do in terms of our academic offerings. And of course, we have been working very close with Delaware County Health Department and IU Ball Memorial Hospital and other medical experts that have really worked with us to make the best decisions and the recommendations. So even though right now the protocols that Kara shared with you are still in place, we're really looking forward to fall and being able to, again, offer our students the traditional student experience that they're used to on our beautiful campus, also do more extracurricular programming that is more robust. And the truth is that even though the vaccines are here and that absolutely creates an incredible opportunity to resume all these activities. We're also fully aware that COVID also continues to be present. So we are going to continue to maintain adequate quarantine and isolation space for our residential students. And we're going to make sure that we follow contact tracing and testing and continue to maintain ample supplies of personal protective equipment and sanitation supplies as well.
And can you talk a little bit about how the university is approaching the vaccine question for staff and students? I mean, are there incentives? I guess, how are you talking about the vaccine and you know, what folks should be doing with that for Ball State folks?
We are very actively encouraging all employees and students to be vaccinated, and we're making the vaccine as easy and accessible as possible. Our College of Health here at Ball State University has been front and center in terms of providing an on-campus site for people to be able to go and easily be vaccinated. We are not currently requiring the vaccine, but we have provided incentives for employees. They will be permitted to really select one of two options. They can either elect to receive a one-time $100 credit off of their employee's portion of the healthcare premium, or they can elect to receive four additional hours of paid leave during the next fiscal year. And for our students, one of the things that we heard from our students themselves was how important it was to them to be vaccinated, because they knew that if they could be vaccinated, they would no longer be required to quarantine. And that was just an incredible value added, because they would not miss out on so many of the experiences that are important to them. So that alone is a large incentive for our students.
Yeah, absolutely. Not having to stay isolated and at home while other things are coming back after a year of missing out on so much.
Exactly.
Yeah. So Kara, can you talk about some of the different course or instruction options that students have, especially that have been spurred by the pandemic and the needs that Ivy Tech students have?
Absolutely. Ivy Tech has long been one of the largest providers of online education in the country, even. And so we continue to be a leader in that space. This fall, it looks like about 30 to 40% of our course sections will actually be delivered fully online. As a result of the pandemic, we actually moved up the launch of a new learning modality that we call Learn Anywhere. And Learn Anywhere actually puts the control of how a class is attended into the student's hands. So the student can choose from class session to class session, whether they're going to be live in the classroom without instructor, whether they're going to attend synchronously via a virtual session, or whether they're going to do that class as essentially an asynchronous online class and log in at some other time and watch the learning content and participate in learning activities. And I just want to applaud our faculty who really were pioneers with this learning modality when we moved up its launch last fall. It had been actually slated to launch this fall with some pilots last year, but we decided, because we have such amazing faculty, that we knew some of them would jump in, and we actually will see about 15% of our schedule offered in that modality this fall. Additionally, we continue to offer blended and virtual classes as well as some traditional classes in the fall.
And why is that important for the students at Ivy Tech? I know that a lot of students are not just coming out of high school, but there's a lot of adults that are continuing education. Can you talk about, I guess, how this is meeting student need?
Of course. So the Learn Anywhere modality actually grew out of an initiative around single parents, because single parents need the flexibility that happens particularly with the pandemic, when students may get sent home from their K-12 school for a couple of weeks and have to quarantine. And so in a traditional academic experience, that could completely destroy their possibility of success if they had to miss 2 weeks while they're staying at home with their child who's quarantining. Because of Learn Anywhere, they don't have to miss class. They can immediately just switch to virtual or switch to asynchronous and still continue on in that same class with those same students and that same instructor and have success in that modality.
Yeah. And Susanna, I know you talked a little bit in, you know, the top of the segment about returning to in-person instruction. Can you talk about why that's so important for Ball State and how, you know, coming back to that is meeting the needs of Ball State students?
Yes, a large part of our university identity is around being able to offer that residential experience. But we also heard from our students, even over the last past year, how much they missed being here on campus and that they felt that they were missing out on the overall experience by only being virtually. In addition, we also realized as we pivoted remotely during the pandemic that there were inequities that were exacerbated by the pandemic and by having to go remote. Not every student had access to the technology that they needed. Those that came from financially challenged backgrounds also experienced that challenge. First-generation students had more difficulty understanding the campus and navigating the resources. So I think that particularly for those populations, but certainly for all of our students, being on campus, not just for the classes, but for the type of broad, comprehensive experience that we offer, the resources that are available here, how we guide them through the resources on campus is very, very important.
Yeah, and can you talk a little bit about the changes that to the school calendar and class schedules that happened and why it's important to change that back to the way it was, I mean, pre-pandemic as well, and how that kind of ties into what you were just talking about?
Yes, absolutely. If you recall, during the pandemic, we had to do away with any of the long-term breaks that we usually have. And I think that that was very difficult just around mental health and wellness for our students, as well as for our employees. These are built-in breaks that are intended to provide a little bit of a breathing room and pauses for employees and students on the student side to really help them process the information, to have a chance to return home if they need to and get that support from their family, from their circle of friends. And not having that and being here really was isolating for them as well. So returning now to that traditional calendar where they will have the Thanksgiving break, the spring break, the fall break, times when families and friends and loved ones get together. I think really you can't underestimate how much support that offers our students, our employees, and it kind of rejuvenates us and restores our energies to be able to finish strong.
Yeah. Taking a little rest and recovery is definitely essential for hardworking college students. I've been there. Those breaks are very critical.
Absolutely.
So, Kara, I wanted to talk about some of the options for staff. Obviously, there's a lot of flexibility for students, but there are people that are teaching these students. So can you talk a little bit about how the school, how Ivy Tech is, you know, approaching staff needs and the options that they have coming into this fall?
Absolutely. It's going to differ quite a bit by position and by the responsibilities of that office and the staffing of that office. But what we want to allow the opportunity is for our teams to embrace some of the learning that they've had during the pandemic about their own work-life balance, about the way that they reach our students. Just as our students are busy working adults who have families and active lives who often can't come in between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m. when we're normally staffed under traditional office hours. We want our staff to be able to meet the needs of our students as they've been doing during the pandemic, perhaps in those non-normal working hours after 5 p.m. or on the weekends. And so we're exploring a lot of different options. One of the interesting things that's come up as we've had faculty and staff listening sessions is, just as we have the learn anywhere concept, our faculty and staff are encouraging us to think about a work anywhere concept. And we are, and we'll see a lot of really innovative models from each of our 19 campuses as we come back in the fall. And we'll continue to tweak those to make sure that we're serving students as best as we can.
Right. Yeah. And Susanna, I'm curious, you were talking about wellness, especially when it comes to the calendar and, you know, offering some breaks from intensive learning for students. I'm curious what sort of programs or supports that Ball State might have put in place for the pandemic that it plans to maybe carry on into the fall to support wellness for not just students, but maybe also staff as well.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we did is we created a remote work policy that will be with us for a long time. And that remote work policy allowed some flexibility for employees who will work with our HR department to see what is appropriate. Like Ivy Tech, as you can imagine, we have a wide diversity of responsibilities, of functions, sizes among our various divisions. And so these plans will differ in some respects, but that remote work policy certainly will be a starting point for people to guide their work and their schedules moving forward. As far as students, we learned many important lessons during the pandemic. Interestingly enough, we found that some of the services that we placed virtually actually worked even better simply because they were more easily accessible by the students, and many more students than normally would were able to engage. To give you some examples, there were things like academic advising. Academic advising virtual appointments were very popular, academic tutoring, other academic support services that we offered virtually. Actually, the level of engagement by the students really increased. So we're going to continue to have a hybrid approach, offering in-person, but also keeping some of the virtual elements. And the same is true with our wellness programs, our counseling center. They really stepped up and offered a lot of different ways of supporting students one-on-one, in groups, in different ways. And I think that those things will also continue. So those are lessons that were very important to learn, and certainly to continue to support students to meet their very different needs.
Yeah, absolutely. And Kara, we've got about a minute and a half left. Can you tell me what stands out to you as the greatest need or challenge for Ivy Tech this upcoming school year, especially in the fall?
Sure. Well, just as Susanna talked about, the disparities and inequities that we found during the pandemic, and we've always known that they were there, but they were certainly amplified both within our institutions and the national audience. It's continuing to pay attention to those. You know, we know that 50% or more of our students are dealing with one or more critical insecurity, whether it be transportation, housing, or food, and then also looking at mental health and well-being. So continuing the great work that we've been doing in those areas, I think, will be critical as we return to campus in the fall.
And Susanna, really quickly, I mean, what are some things that people have missed on campus in the past year? I know you talked about, events and some of the culture on campus with students living there. Is there anything that's coming up in the fall that you're particularly excited to see come back this year?
Yes, and my answer might surprise you. I don't think that we realized how valuable spontaneous and informal conversations can be. I missed being able to walk across campus and run into students and faculty and have conversations about things that mattered to them, things that were exciting to them, being able to actually move things forward and make decisions at the water cooler or by having lunch with someone. These informal interactions, really, you cannot imagine how valuable they are in a campus community and perhaps elsewhere. So I'm really looking forward to be able to do that again.
Yeah, I usually work in a newsroom, and it has been so strange this past year not being able to just walk up to my coworkers and say hey and talk about ideas. And being on a campus definitely has a different feel with all of the remote learning and remote work that people have been doing. So thank you both for taking the time today. This has been a great discussion to hear about what Ivy Tech and Ball State are doing. I want to thank our guests, Karen Monroe is the provost of Ivy Tech Community College, and Susanna Rivera-Mills is the provost at Ball State University. Our producers are Drew Dodlin, Micah Yason, and Tim Brook. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Join us on Monday for a conversation on Asian American Heritage Month. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Jeannie Lindsay. Thanks for listening. This is All In.